What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
It's brand new, season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf at Adam. And we're excited to be back, having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. I'm excited to announce a new season of my podcast, Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers of Marketing. Our guests this season show us big risk can yield big rewards, like Rob Reilly, the creative head of one of the world's leading advertising firms.
I try to create environments where anybody can say anything without any judgment.
Listen to a brand new season of Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
If you want to level up your marketing and business knowledge, look no further than the Marketing School Podcast, hosted by Neil Patel and yours truly, Eric Su. It is the number one marketing podcast on Apple and number 15 on business in the United States. Now, if you want to listen to interesting conversations with operators that have been there, done that, also with other interesting guests, then listen to Marketing School every weekday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Welcome, everyone, to Forward Thinking. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
And today we wanted to talk about something that we think is an interesting subject. It's a bit problematic, but we wanted to talk about vertical farms, what they are, why they might be important, and some of the challenges that we could see if we decide to try and pursue vertical farms as an actual solution. But before we get too far into it, I guess we really need to talk about what exactly is a vertical farm. Really, it's kind of what it sounds like. It's a farm that is arranged vertically as opposed to horizontally. So instead of a big farmland,
wide open space,
exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you start stacking it, kind of. Joe, you were talking about it sort of being like, imagine a greenhouse.
Yeah, well, essentially the main idea is you would have a mostly glass structure that allows sunlight to penetrate. And it would be as if you were to take a greenhouse and put a greenhouse on top of it and then add another greenhouse and keep building up as far as you can go. And the main idea is to see if you can create a farm that stretches up towards the sky instead of out in all directions.
Right. So you're taking advantage of a vertical alignment so that you don't need as much land to produce crops.
Right. And obviously the purpose of this is to fit it within a city, right? Because if you've got plenty of land out in the countryside,
why not
use
it?
That.
Right. Assuming that, of course, the environmental impact would not be so negative as to actually harm the production of crops over a certain amount of time.
Right.
I mean, obviously that's something that you have to take into account. But so really it's kind of an idea of producing crops, even livestock, within an urban environment so that you aren't draining the resources of all the land around you.
Well, yeah, I looked this up. Apparently, according to the USDA, that's the Department of Agriculture, about 51% of the land use in the United States is agriculture.
Wow.
It's farming.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that's a huge number.
Right, right. And as populations grow, obviously that number...
The need is only going to increase.
Right.
Sure.
So putting aside the issue of waste, like how much of that food... or how much of those crops go toward a food source as opposed to for something else, whether it's to feed livestock or to use an energy.
To feed our cars.
Right.
To feed our cars or that gets exported to feed other people.
Right. Once you take out those factors and you just look at the food that we need, it still is one of those things where we need to look at solutions besides just farms. And could vertical farms be that solution? Joe, what was it that you wanted to say?
Well, I guess we need to talk about what are the advantages of a vertical farm.
Right. Well, the version that we're really concentrating on is one that was proposed by Dixon Despommier, who is a Columbia professor. He kind of posed this question in his class and sort of got to thinking about this vertical farm idea. And why would you want that, and how could it have an advantage over traditional farms? And one of them we already answered, which is that it takes up less real estate, less horizontal real estate at any rate. So that's one advantage right there. Another is the idea of producing your food very close to where the consumers are. There's a large percentage of the world's population located in urban areas, and that number is actually growing. More and more people are moving towards cities, or you could look at it as cities are sprawling out to slowly envelop and swallow whole all the people.
Both, right, yeah, because that's where the jobs are. And,
right. Metro Atlanta, I mean, that's a great example. It's definitely more of a sprawl rather than growing up, which is kind of what we're talking about here, is really the concentration is building upward rather than outward. But that's one of the big advantages, right? That you have the food where you need it.
Right. If you could make a vertical farm work, and we'll introduce some challenges to that in a few minutes here, but if you could make it work, you would have fresher produce in the city for one thing. I mean, that's just an advantage in the culinary sphere, mm-hmm. right?
Sure.
Yeah,
that
tasty food
greens,
is a good thing.
Yeah, mm-hmm. that were picked an hour ago
right.
before you get them. And
that
then,
maybe on the floor above you.
Right, exactly. They came down the elevator.
Right.
And also, you would have much less transportation cost. And so that's a – we can look at the economics of that in a minute. But one of the things that has concerned people is this idea of food miles, right?
Right.
How far does your food travel before it gets to you, and how much energy is spent taking the food from a farm in – Kansas or Mexico or Chile or China.
Or Southern California.
Right. Any of these places to get it to your grocery store.
Sure. So we've got the advantage of the food being right here. We have the advantage of you don't have to worry about the transportation costs, although we'll get into that in a second as well. The other advantage, not just the transportation costs from an economic standpoint, you also have greenhouse gas emissions associated with transportation. You've got toxin emissions associated with that. Now, granted, there are greenhouse gas emissions and toxins that are associated just with the production of food. So
sure.
you're not going to get right. around that as much as you would the transportation issue. But that's still something that you can take into consideration with the vertical farms.
Another potential advantage, at least that I've read about, is the ability to reuse materials, especially mm-hmm. water. There's a lot of water that goes into agricultural production. And one idea that's been floated is that you could reuse gray water from residential areas or even in a mixed-use building, say, water that comes from the drain in your sink or in your shower, and that goes to water the crops.
Right. And then, of course, there's also the fact that you would not necessarily need to use up so much soil. We were talking before we started recording about the idea of hydroponics. And essentially, hydroponics is growing crops using a nutrient base that does not require actual soil. You don't have to plant the plants in soil. You use this nutrient base, and usually you have the plants suspended in something like they might have their roots surrounded by a kind of inert gravel or some other item that keeps them upright. Or you could even, in theory, have them suspended, as long as you were able to supply the nutrients to the root systems, then you would be able to continue growing them. Another advantage is the idea that you don't have seasons anymore. Mm. Because if you have a climate-controlled vertical farm, meaning that you have control over how much light is introduced, you have control over the actual temperature, mm-hmm. the moisture levels, the nutrient levels. If you can control all those factors, then you could grow crops all year round. You wouldn't have a season. So you right. wouldn't have to worry like, well, you know, I want to get okra, but it's not in season.
Right. And you don't have to worry about the expense of importing oranges from somewhere extremely far away.
Right.
During,
you could grow them right there.
Grow them right there, yeah.
So this all sounds so great, but I'm not seeing them everywhere yet.
Yeah.
So I wonder if there are some serious challenges that we would have to overcome in order to implement something like this.
There are both serious and humorous challenges to this. no, there are a lot of challenges. One of the big challenges comes down to energy. How much energy do you need to be able to make a vertical farm work? Even when you're talking about conserving water by recycling it as much as possible, even if you're talking about, say, co-location, where you try and put other things that generate heat so that you can use that heat
yeah.
as part of the HVAC system.
If you have a server farm next to your food farm, then you can use the heat from one to
heat the other.
The other.
Right.
So like Google headquarters is right next to the cornfield.
Right.
That wouldn't
the corn towers.
That actually wouldn't surprise me one bit knowing the way Google works. But and in fact Google does have some of the largest data farms out there. But That's still just one part of the problem. I mean, the taller you build the building, the greater your energy needs are to keep that system going.
Because right.
you know it's water circulation, it's the heating and cooling, it's the artificial light. Because
right.
one of the issues you have is how do you design a tall building to take advantage of sunlight? Because it's yep. not going to be – the sunlight's not going to be evenly distributed across each floor for an entire day.
In a horizontal farm, the sun is free and
yeah.
it's – yeah, it becomes a whole separate problem.
Right. And so when you have a vertical farm, then for it to really work, you're going to have to supplement the light that any one floor gets in some way, whether that is through – moving the plants around, mm-hmm. because, Joe, you were talking about
yeah.
a system that was kind of interesting.
Well, one thing you've seen in a couple of prototypes is something like a Ferris wheel. You load the plants up to a moving tray or cart of some kind, and it cycles them through with giving them greater access to the light from the roof as the day goes on. But, of course, you're still dealing with a problem there that even if you cycle them through – they're not getting the constant
optimal,
right,
total
getting
light
well.
That they
sure,
would get
exactly.
if you just planted them in the middle of a field.
So really you have to supplement the light in some way, either by moving the plants or by creating artificial sunlight.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that you're actually expending energy just to give them the energy they normally would get for free if it was in a horizontal farm. So that's something that a lot of people have pointed out as a big problem, and the idea that it's not energy efficient to build these vertical farms, even if you are talking about supplementing the energy they require with things like solar panels or wind turbines, you're probably not going to generate the energy you need to keep that going without it tapping into the power grid. And the question then becomes, is it actually more energy efficient to operate a vertical farm versus a traditional farm? And
right.
if it's less energy efficient, then
why are we doing it?
Right. Especially when you're talking about artificial light. That's the big one. Because you're like, this is a resource that is literally free to us with
mm-hmm.
the traditional setup. And it costs us in the vertical setup. So unless we can demonstrate that the benefit we get from the vertical standpoint is greater than the energy expenditure that we get using this method, why do we do it?
Well, so these concerns are out there, and we know that people have had to think about them before they've invested in prototypes of vertical farms. But so one thing it might help to do is to look at where people have tried to build these things and see what reasons might have motivated them.
Right.
One thing I think we all read about, of course, is an NPR piece about the Sky Greens farm, right, in
right.
Singapore.
Right.
Of course, Singapore seems like an ideal location for a vertical farm because – I mean, real estate values there. It's
oh,
one of the
yeah.
most densely populated places on Earth, isn't
sure,
it?
Sure, yes.
And so obviously there's no room in Singapore to really go out and lay out a
horizontal. Unless you're going to raise a few buildings, then yeah, you're not going to build any farms out there horizontally.
So it may be an issue of there's an economic conflict here. There are great costs to investing in something like this, but in tight enough circumstances, it might pay off.
Right, yeah. In certain countries where you either have very little farmable land that's available, or the seasons just don't really fall in such a way that makes it easy for you to grow anything, it might actually make a lot of sense to do vertical farms. Although a lot of people have argued that perhaps the greenhouse route would be as efficient or perhaps more efficient. So apart from the energy barriers that we have here with vertical farms, there may also be economic barriers. First of all, just building a vertical farm would require a pretty enormous initial investment. So that asking for that can be difficult. And also,
you'd be taking a risk, too, because it's somewhat unproven.
Sure. Right? Mm-hmm. And if you are spending all this money, that also may mean that in order to recapture those costs, that you end up having to charge more for the produce you produce within the vertical farm.
Right, right. Although, you know, at a certain point, is it worth it if you can get a tomato that is incredibly delicious and only have to go upstairs to get it? Is, you know, would people pay for that?
Right. I mean, if you buy greens that are picked today, people would pay up for that, I think.
Well,
I mean,
yeah.
Some
people would. They say in that same piece we were talking about, they said in Singapore the greens from that vertical farm there would cost 5 to 10% more than standard grains at the grocery store, but people were buying them.
Well, it's not bad. I mean, you know, a 5 to 10% increase is, you know, I was thinking of some kind of outrageous, like 50-70% kind of increase in food costs.
It might be that much in other scenarios.
Right. It would all depend. Sure. And so the vertical farms may make a lot more sense in particular communities, you know, where we have these pre-existing conditions. Like, for example, there are islands in the Caribbean where they have really no agriculture whatsoever.
Sure.
So they import everything. Or there are communities, say, in Alaska or Hawaii that have to import a lot of the stuff they use. And those expenses get pretty high because they're in fairly remote areas. That's, you know, it's a challenge to get stuff there in a way that's efficient and economically feasible. So it may make perfect sense there. It might actually offset some of the prices that they're spending on certain items right now.
Right. If you live in a place like New York or something like that, or even in Atlanta, it might make sense to target certain crops for vertical farming.
Right.
To say, you know, well, we have fairly close access to the corn and all these other things we
peaches.
Need. But we really, you know, we've got to fly vegetables in from Europe or from South America if we want this special fruit or something like that.
Right. So, yeah, if I want my wasabi, I have to fly it in either from one place in Hawaii or Japan.
So in those cases, it might make sense to invest in urban farming solutions for
things like grapes that don't grow very well here in this particular. Yeah, that's a terrible example because we totally have wine country in the Georgia Hills. There's wine in them, their hills.
Even so, the point being that depending upon where in the world you are, you may not have access to certain kinds of foods. And so if you were to design vertical farms that specifically targeted that, then that would be a reason to do so.
Right. And this also I wanted to mention might kind of go along with, I think, what is going to need to happen, which is a little bit of a change in perception of food, because we're all so used to being able to get whatever we want whenever we want it. And if we really want to live in a more energy conservative way, we're not always going to have access to Green Globe grapes that we can just run down to the store and grab. We might need to start.
Your future is dark and frightening, Lauren.
Well, but you know, but it's not a terrible thing to think more about eating seasonally and appreciating really good strawberries when you get them versus having terrible cardboard strawberries 6 months out of the year that cost you five times more than they otherwise would.
Well, and also another solution that people could look at for these problems that we're talking about with these vertical farms, some of them involve just designing buildings differently.
Sure.
Like instead of, you know, we all have kind of a stock image in our minds of what a skyscraper looks like, but some of these vertical farms look a lot different from that image. For example, there are some designs that are tiered in a way so that each level is slightly smaller than the level below it. which increases the amount of sunlight the lower levels can receive on any given day. And, you know, you orient that building when you build it to such a way so that you get as much sunlight throughout a typical day as you possibly can, and you lower the need for things like that artificial sunlight we were talking about earlier.
Of course, then it becomes less like the skyscraper.
Right.
Right. So.
But it's still a vertical farm.
Right.
It's just not in the form. It's not necessarily
vertical.
Yeah. It's not like a multi-use building where, you know, floors 1 through 15 are residential, 16 through 30 are offices, and 31 through 50 are farms. It's mm-hmm. it's not like that, mm-hmm. but it would still be a vertical farm. It just might not stretch up 30 stories, it may be more like 15, but
a diagonal farm.
Yeah.
Still vertical.
Yeah. No, I believe you.
I can show you pictures. Not an audio podcast, unfortunately. But these are the possible solutions we're looking at. And beyond that, there are alternatives. We have people living in urban areas today who are looking at or even creating gardening spaces and farming spaces within the city limits.
Yeah. There's lots of park space that is certainly gorgeous, but it can be gorgeous and also have apple trees. You know, it doesn't – these things don't – food does not have to be mutually exclusive with urban beauty.
Right.
And also rooftop gardens or small personal gardens on a porch are all terrific ways to get a little bit extra food.
There's actually quite a few community gardens in the Atlanta area in mm-hmm. particular. In fact, I know of three or four that are pretty close to where I live. Now, that can be complicated because depending upon what city you live in, there may be very strict rules
zoning
as to
issues.
What you can
mm-hmm.
and cannot sure. grow. But that's one of those things that could help offset the need for going outside the city limits to get your food.
Those rooftop gardens have a lot of advantages, don't they? Don't they say that they like cut down on that urban heat island effect?
Sure.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. They also, of course, all plants take in carbon dioxide. So there's
just as long as we've got cars is a pretty excellent thing.
Right. It's a carbon dioxide sink. It may not offset
though,
everything.
How many gardens would you need?
That brings up another criticism I've read about vertical farms and the idea that in greenhouses and in these vertical farm models, often you would want to pump in more carbon dioxide than would normally be in a regular mixture of atmosphere in an attempt to essentially you're feeding the plants, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like it would be like an oxygen-rich environment for us.
Right, so it'd be a carbon dioxide-rich environment for them. And I've read some criticisms that say, well, you know, how do you get the carbon dioxide? And one of the common ways is through combustion. You burn something and carbon dioxide is – but that just ends up releasing other elements. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So there are, again, more problems here. But it's not all bad. And of course, even if we reach the ideal vertical farm world where it makes perfect sense. Maybe we have some energy surplus for some reason. We've cracked that nut and the energy isn't an issue anymore. So we can, depending upon your point of view, invest or waste energy on these vertical farms.
The fusion reactor is online.
Right.
Let's build vertical farms.
Right.
Vertical farms.
We've harnessed the power of the galaxy itself and now we're going to have our vertical farms. Gosh darn it. But even if we do that, the numbers really don't add up. It's really hard to envision a world where we have enough vertical farms to offset the need for our food. So it looks
it's not just hard, it's kind of impossible, right? There's just a scale problem.
We would essentially replace all of our buildings with vertical farms.
Right.
And even then that wouldn't work, right? I mean, what the vertical farming future, if it is a feasible possibility, it's supplemental. It's not to replace all of the horizontal
traditional farms,
agriculture.
Right.
It can't. It can't possibly.
Right. So really what we're looking at is a way to kind of offset it a little bit, to reduce our reliance upon traditional horizontal farms and thus reduce the impact that we make either through the whole the production process, the environmental impact of just clearing out land to make a farm. We can definitely take a chunk of that out, which is an important part of conservation and sustainability. Especially if we do things like Lauren, you were mentioning when we were meeting about this earlier. You know, if we were to shift our diets to be more of a vegetable and fruit heavy diet as opposed to eating lots and lots of meat, then
yeah,
that
yeah, it takes something like 1,600 liters of water to raise a 2-pound steak. Not even a 2-pound cow. I mean, like a yeah,
two-pound steak. I'm just thinking about just nurturing a 2-pound steak.
How many big gulps of water is that?
That's a lot. It's a lot of big gulps. I mean, obviously, if we were to shift to a more vegetarian type of diet, not necessarily strictly vegetarian, but more so, then we would
alleviate a lot of the need for that kind of thing.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly.
And also, yeah, there's probably a lot of crops that are a lot more. I mean, you know, a watermelon is a lot more difficult to grow, for example, than I don't have a good counterexample. But watermelons, man, lots of water. Shockingly enough. No, seriously.
It's right there in the name. Yeah. I would imagine more so than, say, a cucumber. But anyway, yeah, it's an interesting idea, and it's definitely one of those things where you can look at it and you see like a artist rendering of what a vertical farm could look like, and you're like, wow, that's a super cool building of the future. And also, these are the same sort of techniques that we're looking at as possible ways of helping us get from Earth to some distant planet. I mean, these these growing techniques, these things that we have to take into consideration just to grow plants here on Earth in urban settings could eventually inform us in our quest to get off this rock and visit other planets. So, you know, it's definitely got its use. And we don't mean to downplay the importance of vertical farms. It may very well be that one day they are a common sight in any major metropolitan area. But there are issues that we definitely need to take into consideration and acknowledge before we jump right in.
Well, we know it's not a sure thing yet.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean it's not a good idea to keep trying.
Definitely, right. Yeah.
Trying at things that are hard or even seem impossible is how we innovate.
Make improvements, right? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And if nothing else, even if we eventually get to the conclusion that vertical farms are not a viable way to go, we could learn that there are other through that process, we could learn other things that improve growing in traditional farms. Or even if we just say, okay, maybe we don't make vertical farms, but we do make more greenhouses within urban areas to help with this issue. No matter what, we learn through that process. So like you were saying, Joe, it's definitely a positive thing in the long run. It just might be a little longer than what everyone was hoping for. That's okay. That's what the future is for. We get
nothing
there.
But the future.
That's it.
The future is everywhere.
It is. So anyway, guys, thank you so much for listening. I hope you are enjoying the podcast, the video series. Remember, we have blogs at fwthinking.com that you can go and check out. We write about stuff that relates to the podcast. We also write about other topics that we don't really touch on in either the series or the podcast. So I highly recommend you check that out. And follow us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, follow us on Google+. Let us know what you are interested in. We definitely want to tackle those futuristic topics that are just gnawing at your brain. You've got to know, how is it going to turn out? We want to hear from you. So get in touch with us, and we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.
It's brand new season 2. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedatum. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know like Vilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. I'm excited to announce a new season of my podcast, Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers of Marketing. Our guests this season show us big risk can yield big rewards, like Rob Reilly, the creative head of one of the world's leading advertising firms.
I try to create environments where anybody can say anything without any judgment.
Listen to a brand new season of Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you want to level up your marketing and business knowledge, look no further than the Marketing School Podcast, hosted by Neil Patel and yours truly, Eric Hsu. It is the number one marketing podcast on Apple and number 15 on business in the United States. Now, if you want to listen to interesting conversations with operators that have been there, done that, also with other interesting guests, then listen to Marketing School every weekday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Rachel Zoe here, and we're going back to the Rachel Zoe Project for a very special takeover on my podcast, Climbing in Heels. Come with me as I take you back to season one to give you all the behind-the-scenes details and drama. I'll be joined by some special guests that'll be helping me share the real stories behind the most iconic moments in the show. So do not miss this special takeover of Climbing in Heels. It's going to be bananas. Listen to Climbing in Heels with Rachel Zoe on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.